So for tonight, I thought I would talk about faith and belief, what these mean, what these meant to the Buddha, what these mean in Buddhism, and what's the proper attitude towards these things. Faith is... People use the word faith often just to mean religion. Different people talk about different faiths. Faith has become synonymous with religion. So the idea is that different religions, they've all got different faiths. This person has faith in this teaching or this teacher, and a different person has faith in someone else. So some people have faith in Jesus or God or the Christian church. Others have faith in Muhammad. Others have faith in the Buddha or Confucius. And this is it shows a certain kind of attitude, just even saying that the essence of a religion is what you believe, what you have faith in. I remember after I became I don't know how long, but I remember being asked sometime after I'd become a Buddhist, someone asked me, I've been a Buddhist for quite a while, I can't remember how long, but someone said, "Oh, so what do Buddhists believe then?" The question took me by surprise, kind of stumped me, and I thought, I had to think, I don't know, what do Buddhists believe? So I never thought about it, I'd never really thought about it that way. It's not a question, it wasn't the way I looked at Buddhism. I had to think about it, and I thought, well, I suppose... I thought of a few things. I suppose Buddhists believe, and I came up with the essential thing. I believe the Buddha was the Buddha. The Buddha was enlightened, and a few other things like this. But the thing that got me was that's not the way in Buddhism we look at the. It's not the kind of question you ask. What do we believe? When I was at school as a Christian, went to a Christian school, we were told what to believe, and we could recite it. I believe this, that, and the other. And what you believed was very important, and faith, in the sense of believing, at least asserting that I believe this, that, or the other. I believe God the Father and so forth. It was very important and emphasised, and it seemed to be faith in the sense of you take one thing, you've got to take the whole kit and caboodle. So if you want to be a Catholic, you don't. It's not enough to just say, "Well, I believe this bit and this bit, but that bit I'm not so sure about." You have to take it all on faith. Take it on faith. What's meant there by the word faith is, it seemed to me, and maybe I've misunderstood it, but it seemed to me to be you've got to basically assert to others and to yourself that I know this is to be true. I know this is true. I have real faith that this is true. Not just that I believe it. Well, I think it's likely that I know it's true. And if you start to doubt it, if you think, maybe it's not, that's actually seen as something quite terrible, because your faith is shaking. You're doubting, and this doubt in that sense is a bad thing. It's always struck me as a bit of an odd, an odd thing. That blind faith basically would seem to be praised, and the idea that if you question things, it's better to have faith to believe even without having seen any evidence than to look for the evidence. To look for the evidence that's a sign of doubt. Oh, ye of little faith, it's not good. And it's my own way of thinking. Even as a child, I thought this is a bit odd. I couldn't understand why. Doubting Thomas was criticised. I thought, well, that's reasonable, isn't it? Surely, if you haven't got any proof of something. I wanted to talk about the kind of attitude the Buddha had towards this, because faith is praised in Buddhism too. Faith is one of the spiritual faculties, but it's not. Faith can mean different things to different people, and I'm not sure that I'm representing the Christian attitude to faith correctly, but that's how I understood it when I was a child, that you expected to just believe, and if you questioned it, maybe just because you were a child, and maybe if adults questioned it, they'd get a bit different kind of response. But we didn't get a very good, healthy response from our teachers if we questioned, do animals have souls and things like this. But in the Buddhist attitude, I'll talk about some of the things the Buddha said. There's the most famous and very often quoted incident in the scriptures of Buddhism was when what was known as the Kalama Sutta, a group of people, a tribe or a nation who were known as the Kalamas, and the Buddha visited this place. The Buddha used to wander from place to place, living off of the food people would give him and teaching when people asked him questions. These people came to him and said, we get all these different teachers coming through, and some people teach one thing, and then someone else comes along and they teach the complete opposite. And each one says, this is the true faith, if you like. This is the real faith. This is the way things really are. Those other people are talking rubbish. This is the way things really are. I know it. This is a fact. And you shouldn't believe them. Just believe me. But then someone else will come along and say the opposite or something very different. And then someone else will come along and say something different again. So their question to the Buddha was, who should we believe? How do we know who to believe and what to believe? And the Buddha didn't, fortunately, he didn't say, believe me. He's lucky, I'm fully enlightened, so you're in luck. He did say at different times, in different contexts, in different situations, he did say things like this to people. He'd say, well, I'm fully enlightened and you can trust me. But the word trust, as opposed to having blind faith, that's the important thing, the important difference. So, but what the Buddha said to the Kalamas was, I'll talk about the difference between faith, belief, trust, confidence later on. But so what the Buddha said to the Kalamas, he said, well, it's natural for you to doubt and not know who to believe, because they're all saying different things. You don't know for a fact these things they're talking about. So if they're talking about things like what happens when you die, what happens after death, you can't verify this for yourself. So naturally you have doubts. People say they have teachings about morality and what kind of things are moral and immoral, and they disagree with each other about severity of different things. And how do you decide what's right and wrong? So it's natural for you to have doubts. So then he said, he told them things not to believe in, bad reasons for believing. And so unusually for a religious teacher, he said, well, don't believe something just because because it's in the scriptures. Don't believe it just because it's in your holy books or whatever. So if it's in the Bible, or if it's in the Buddhist suttas, or if it's in the Quran, just because it's in a book and someone's written it down doesn't mean it's true. Today he might have said, don't believe what you read in the papers, or don't believe everything you see on the internet, or whatever. But just because something's been said and it's in print, doesn't mean it's true. I was talking about this with a monk yesterday, and he said, he told me that in the Goon show, Spike Milligan character was asked once, well, how do you know it's 11 o'clock? And he said, I've got it written down on a piece of paper. So, and this is kind of like, can be a bit like this with just because something's written down in the past, it may not necessarily be true. It may even be ridiculous to believe it. So don't believe things just because it's in the scriptures and things. That in itself is not a good reason, because people write truth, people write lies. People are deluded. Maybe the people who wrote the thing didn't know what they were talking about. Or maybe they did, but over the time, in the copying and passing it down, it's being corrupted or miscopied. So don't trust something simply because it's in the scriptures. And this is equally true of the Buddhist scriptures. Also, he said, don't believe it just because your teacher tells you. So just because you've got a guru or a teacher or a Buddhist monk, me, sitting here giving a talk, don't assume that they know what they're talking about. Even if they say they do, they might be deluded, they might be a bit confused, they might might be lying, they might be saying things just for gain or for whatever reason, but they might just be honestly, more likely, just honestly mistaken. So, and the same for the Buddha, don't believe it just because the Buddha says it. And he went on about various, like, those kind of authority, so basically just because hearsay or because everybody says it or because, it's a very popular notion, these kind of things. He said it in a number of different ways, but all meaning just that kind of authority from without, from other people. Then he also said, and this is less often kind of noticed about this sutta, because what this seems to imply, and often people talk about this particular teaching, is if what he meant was simply what he meant was just like, just trust your own ideas. Trust your own ideas. Don't just believe other people. But see for yourself. And there is that aspect, see for yourself. But he also said, don't trust your own ideas. So he also said, don't believe in things because of tradition, the sacred scriptures, your teacher, out of respect. Also, don't believe in reason. Don't believe just because it seems logical. Don't believe in something just because you worked it out in your head. Don't believe it because it seems, on reflection, it seems kind of likely. So he listed a number of different ways, all saying the same kind of thing about just, using the intellect, working it out with your intellect. What does that leave? So if you're not going to believe what other people have told you, and you can't trust yourself. But he said, he finished by saying, on the positive side, he says, but when you know for yourself that these things, certain things are good, they're wholesome, they lead to happiness, not to suffering, that these things are praised by the wise, these things are wholesome, good things, then behave that way. And when you know that certain things are bad, unwholesome, criticized by the wise, they lead to suffering, then abandon those things. So there's a number of interesting things about this. Is that firstly, he's, for one thing, although he said don't believe others, when he said how you should behave, he mentioned things that are praised by the wise and criticized by the wise. So you don't completely ignore other people's views and opinions. And so if, for instance, you have faith in the Buddha, if you think the Buddha is a wise person, and people living at the time who had met him, someone might have enormous faith in the Buddha. So you'd take what he says into account. In other words, don't believe him blindly, but you can take these things into account. And if you know that, for instance, almost all religious teachers say it's bad to kill, then that's something to bear in mind. There's something that they all agree with this. Wise people tend to say that violence is unwholesome, that violence is bad, doesn't solve problems. Killing isn't good. You bear that in mind as well as your own experience. Does it lead to suffering? So there's a good test of experience and things. What happens when I do this? What are the results? And from experience, you tend to learn certain things. When I behave in this way, it always ends in tears. Maybe I should stop doing that. I always end up regretting it. So the appeal to experience there, and this is one of the really important thing. You use your own experience, but not your reasoning and logic, just experience. When you've seen, he says, when you know from yourself, from maybe bitter experience, when you know for yourself that these things are bad, don't do them. Because some things we do know, it's bad to be violent. Not to, if someone annoys you. Thump them. This is what I used to do when I was a child. If someone annoyed me a lot, I'd thump them. But I gradually learned that it wasn't so good. And, I think I knew it quite a long time ago, but for me, there's no question. That's something I know, that just to physically attack people you don't like, that's bad. It's not good. It leads to suffering. There's nothing positive to be said about it. But you can't prove that. And there are people who don't believe it, and there are people who actually think, just look after number one, get them before they get you, this kind of thing. So there are people who believe that the morality, there is no basis for morality, that whatever you do is okay, so you may as well do whatever get the maximum benefit for yourself, and benefit for these people is measured in terms of wealth, prestige, whatever, being able to force others to do what you want. You can't prove to people who have that kind of attitude that they're wrong. You can't demonstrate by proof. So reasoning doesn't work. And likewise, people have used reason to defend all sorts of appalling and ludicrous things. There's a saying that there is no idea so ludicrous that there isn't some philosopher who will defend it and actually say that it's the truth. I mean, throughout, certainly in Western philosophy and the same in Eastern philosophy, there have been philosophers who've said the most ludicrous kind of ideas and defended these things because they've worked it out in their heads and it seems to them very reasonable. So it's experience rather than logical reasoning which we can depend on. The other, I think, important thing to notice about what the Buddha's answer is that they asked him, well, what should we believe? And he didn't say you should believe this or that, or even say this is how you should decide how to believe. What he said is, they asked him, what should we believe? And his answer was, this is how you should behave. He didn't say believe this or believe that, believe things based on this, that, and the other. He said, don't believe your teachers, don't believe tradition, don't believe holy scriptures, don't believe your mind, don't believe your reason and logic, but behave like this. When things are good, behave like that. When things are bad, don't behave like that. So he talked about what to do, not what to believe in. Because for the Buddha, it's what you believe in isn't the point. That's not the point. It's what we do is the point. So how we behave. And Buddhism, this is why I was confused by the question and thrown off, what do Buddhists believe? Because I'd never thought about it that way. Because it's not about belief. It's about behavior. It's a path. That's why the phrase, the Eightfold Path, calling the Buddha's teachings a path, he used that idea because it's a path to be trodden. It's something to be done, not something to believe in. So it's a kind of method or way of life rather than a set of beliefs. So in this way, it's got some similarities from some other religions. Now, other religions also have things to do and ways we should behave and ways we shouldn't behave. But tends to be a lot more emphasis on the things you're supposed to believe as well. So for the Buddha, his attitude is that there are things which are true and there are certain things in particular which it's not so good to believe and hold fast to. And some things which is very, very useful. So, as part of the Eightfold Path, the first factor is right understanding, or right view, or right—you might even say right belief—and the idea of karma and rebirth, and the idea that karma bears fruit. But it's not so much that Buddhists have to believe these things. More, the idea with right view is more that if you hold absolutely fast to mistaken views, they can be an obstruction to you. So it's the holding fast which is the main problem there. So he went on to say then taking the example of one aspect of Buddhist teaching which people have, many Westerners have problems with, is rebirth. And when I first came to Buddhism as well, it was the teachings about suffering and the causes and the way out of suffering that attracted me to Buddhism and how the mind works. And I could see, oh yes, this had a lot of, faith arose in that. But that in itself didn't make me think, oh yeah, and when you die, you're reborn. I hadn't believed that before. I assumed that when you die, that's the end. So when I saw this teaching of rebirth, I thought, I don't know about that. I was kind of a bit sceptical about this. But I thought, I don't know. It's like I'm agnostic. I mean, what happens when you die? I don't know. The Buddha says you're reborn. It doesn't seem essential. The important things about Buddhism is about how to behave and how to end suffering. So, I just leave that aside. I was very pleased then when I discovered that the Buddha actually specifically said this himself. He said, don't worry about it. So to the Kalamas, he said, suppose there's no rebirth, and when you die, that's the end. well, you'll be happy in this life if you behave well. If you lead a good life, good moral life, then you'll be happy. And it doesn't matter what happens when you die. If you lead a bad life, you'll be unhappy in this life. And even if there's no rebirth, then you've made a bad decision. But if there is a life to come, and if there is the workings of karma, then if you behave badly, you'll suffer not just in this life, but really badly in future lives. And if you behave well, and there is rebirth, then you'll have a happy future life too. So either way, whichever way it turns out, rebirth is true, rebirth isn't true. Whichever way it turns out, this is the right way to behave. So it doesn't actually matter so much. It's not essential to believe this. So that was reassuring that the Buddha said that, because that was kind of my attitude. Now, over time, actually, for a number of different reasons, partly through just getting used to the idea, we tend to just kind of get used to ideas, really. I got used to the idea of rebirth and realized it's not such a ridiculous idea at all. And then I heard more people talk about it in other ways. And then also, more recently, I discovered there is actually some evidence, some kind of scientific evidence for it, which surprised me a lot, because I thought I'd never find evidence for it. It was just a matter of belief. So that this attitude of not having to believe to begin with, and even praising skepticism, because the Buddha, he actually said you shouldn't believe things just because you've been told them. You've got to see for yourself when you know for yourself. So don't take someone else's word for it. See for yourself. Don't just assume what's true. But nonetheless, you can follow other people's advice. So it's okay to read holy scriptures. It's okay to listen to people you think are wise and see what they say. But then you've got to go away and test it for yourself against experience. So in this way, some people question, is Buddhism a religion? Because of the fact there's no God in Buddhism. And I think also because of the fact that there isn't this idea of blind belief, a set of beliefs you have to believe in. I don't know. The question, is it religion, isn't it religion? It's just a word. It is religion, I suppose, because the Buddha talks about the afterlife and things like this. But in many ways, it's more akin to like the scientific approach, which is why it appeals to a lot of people with kind of scientific backgrounds. Because you're expected to test things out for yourself. The Buddha said, the Dhamma is timeless. He said, he gave a number of descriptions of it. One he used was ahipassiko, which literally means it's come and see-ish. In other words, it's verifiable. It invites you to come and look, test it out for yourself. That's the nature of the teaching he gave, is it invites you to test for yourself, not to just believe blindly. So it's like, it's testable, it's falsifiable. You can test these things. Now, some of the things you might think, okay, but how can you test the idea of rebirth? I'll come to that actually later on if I get to the point I'm intended to reach. But firstly, a lot of the teachings of Buddhism are easily testable. They're the ones you focus on first. You can see what kind of things make me happy, what things make me miserable, what things lead to disaster, what kind of behavior is good. You trial and error. You do things, you see that doesn't work, then maybe you stop doing it. If you see I suffer a lot when I get into arguments and shout at people, things tend not to go so well, maybe I should stop doing that. If I eat too much or just overindulge in things, maybe I just get, it's just all too much and I regret it later. So you experiment with life, you use your own life as a laboratory, you test, you see what works, what doesn't work, and you abandon what doesn't work. There are other ways. The Buddhist attitude is very similar to the kind of scientific method. The idea, the fact that, as I said, it's a path, it's a method, it's not a set of facts, things to believe, it's a way of approaching life, it's a way of approaching knowledge. In the same way that science isn't a set of facts, it's a kind of method. And also, a very important part of the Buddha's teachings is the idea of cause and effect. Things don't just spontaneously happen. The Buddha said, things happen because of causes. They don't just happen. There's a cause for everything. And the Buddha's enlightenment came about through an investigation of these causes. He asked himself, you know, why is there so much suffering in the world? Why do we die? And he asked these questions and traced the process back to its origins. So why does this come about? Well, this comes about because of that. Well, why does that come about? Well, that comes about because of this other thing. Well, why does that come about? And traced it back until he could see the process by which suffering happens. And seeing the process, he was able to then see the method by which you can end that process. So this idea that things don't just happen spontaneously, it's not a kind of, for the Buddha, we don't live in this miraculous world without law or reason and things just happen. They happen for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. And if you can understand the workings of the world, then you can know how to behave and know how to shape the world in the way you want, you know, to be happy. So, and this aspect of wisdom, and it's very important to understand the difference between belief and knowledge, you know, how we can know what we know, and do we really know something, or do we just believe it? Because for Buddhism, our suffering comes about ultimately because when the Buddha traced it back, he realized the basic problem is ignorance, delusion, seeing the world in the wrong way and then behaving inappropriately. Because we're deluded, this is where all our suffering comes from. And the end of suffering comes about through wisdom or knowledge, through cutting through and seeing things as they are, seeing reality as it actually is. So it's important to know, not just to believe. Just believing will not get you enlightened. Having enormous faith in the Buddha just by itself will not get you enlightened and will not end your suffering. So you have to understand for yourself. It's not just enough to believe what someone else says. So just to say, yes, I believe totally, I have total faith in the Buddha, and you know, you go along, go to listen to talks, do all the right things and everything. That won't get you anywhere by itself. It's of a help. It's helpful because believing in the Buddha means you're likely to listen to what he says and follow his advice. And then if you follow his advice, then you're more likely to follow the path and actually get to the goal. So the actual, but just believing it in itself isn't enough. So, let's talk about science. In some ways, the Buddhism is similar to science, but in many ways, it's very different. And it's not a science. It is a religion. Because for one thing, as I mentioned earlier, the Buddha said, "Don't trust reason." So that, don't trust that either. That's not going to get you. That's not going to get you to truth. So this is the difference between scientific method, because that relies on logic and reason, relies on experiment and seeing for yourself, testing for yourself. But it also relies on reason, and believes that that's the way we learn about the world. That's the way we reach the truth. Whereas for the Buddha, that's not the way. That's not the way. It won't get you anywhere. Because reason, there are a number of problems with it. Reasoning leads to doubt, basically. Reasoning is basically building one concept on top of another and piling them up on top of each other. Using logic to, you know, if this is true, then that's true, then if that's true, that's true, and so forth. But if where you're starting from isn't true, then you're not getting anywhere. And the problem with our ideas is that we're starting from ignorance and delusion. So all of our ideas are already off the mark. And if we build on these ideas to build new ideas, they're just going to be off the mark too. So this isn't the way we actually reach knowledge in Buddhism. So for the Buddha, the method, you know, how do we know when something's true? How do we know when we know? Another simile he gave was of someone following an elephant's elephant tracks. He said, suppose an elephant tracker saw this huge elephant's footprint, it was very, very large. He doesn't come to the conclusion that's a big bull elephant, which he's seeking. Because sometimes there are very large female elephants, and that could be one of them. So he follows the tracks, and then he sees some scrapings on a tree and another huge footprint. But he still doesn't come to the conclusion, well, that's a big bull elephant, because some of these female elephants have sharp teeth and have, you know, large footprints. So it might be one of them. So he carries on following it. And then he sees some scrapings higher up and some broken off branches, and I can't remember exactly what else. And he still doesn't come to the conclusion that it's definitely a bull elephant. And he goes on a bit further and he sees another footprint and the scrapings and a huge bull elephant sitting at the bottom of a tree. And he says, that's the big bull elephant. And now he knows. It's not just belief or confidence. He knows that's the bull elephant because he's seen it for himself. In the same way, following a religion, you have to start with faith, some kind of faith. Even coming here, you may not be Buddhist, but at least you've got some kind of confidence or belief or faith that there might be something worth listening to here. And maybe you've got more faith than that, and you think there probably will be. So you've got to have some kind of faith to even bother listening to the Buddha or to another teacher. So you have to start from there. But that is not yet, you don't yet know, even if you have a lot of faith, you don't know the Buddha is fully enlightened. You don't know that the Dhamma he taught is true. You just have confidence, a certain amount of confidence in it. But then you start practicing the path and you meditate. And just as the Buddha had explained, you get some very, you get a lot, even before the meditation, you just practice the morality that he taught and sense restraint and calm yourself down. And you get a lot of joy from this. And you think, well, it's true what the Buddha said about these things. But still, you don't come to the conclusion that Buddha's fully enlightened and the Dhamma is all true, because you've only verified certain aspects of it. But naturally, your faith is increased. You have more confidence in the Buddha. If you test it out and you see that the parts you've tested are true, then you've got more confidence about the other thing that he talks about. Maybe he is enlightened. Maybe rebirth is true. Maybe karma is true. Then you meditate and you get some amazing experiences. You get maybe a lot of enormous amount of peace, more than you'd ever experienced any other time in your life. And when that happens, you know, your faith, you know, goes through the ceiling. I mean, it's just like, this is amazing. I know, you know, this really is true. You can have some, even though I believed it before, now I know it. You know, these things really are true, and you have even more faith. But still, you don't know that the Buddha is enlightened. You still don't know about rebirth just because you've had amazing meditation. But it spurs you on to carry on further along the path, keep looking. Eventually, if you carry on like this, following the path, you reach the point where you become enlightened yourself. At that point, that's like seeing the bull elephant. At that point, you no longer need faith. You know it's true. But you only know finally, completely, you only have that absolute faith in the sense of being, you know, I have no doubt whatsoever, if you're honest with yourself. You only have that when you've finally reached the goal yourself. So this is the attitude the Buddha recommended towards things like these mystical, you know, what happens when we die. You know, the Buddha has certain teachings, other religions have other teachings. It's okay to have confidence in them, to have a bit of faith, but it's not really, you're not really honouring truth, the Buddha said. You're not honouring truth if you say, this is the way it is, and anyone who says differently is wrong. If you say, I believe in rebirth, or I believe in God, then you're honouring truth, because you're saying what is a fact. You're saying, I believe in this or that. I believe in Santa Claus. That's maybe true. If you say, yes, Santa Claus definitely exists, and he's got reindeers, and all this kind of thing, then you're not honouring truth, because it may be true, it may be false. So this is the attitude to have to things, just to remember that I don't actually know. I have confidence in this, I don't know. So this word confidence, this is really, sometimes the word saddha, which the Buddha praised, and which is usually translated as faith, sometimes people translate it as confidence. And in many aspects, it's more to do with confidence. So you have confidence in the Buddha. I have confidence in the Buddha, a lot of confidence in the Buddha and his teachings. And that's why I'm a Buddhist. And why I'm a Buddhist monk. I have confidence that it will work. Faith is another, you can use the word faith, but not in the sense of, I know absolutely, you know, not the sense of blind faith, just confidence. And it's okay to be confident. Confidence is good. So the opposite of confidence is doubt and confusion. These things aren't good. The opposite of blind faith is skepticism. And skepticism is good too. So the Buddha praised skepticism. He said, don't believe people just because it's in the suttas. Don't believe it just because the Buddha said so. Don't believe it just because your teacher says, or because everyone believes that. So that's the skeptical attitude. Not the cynical attitude, or not an overly skeptical attitude, where you don't believe anything. Man, there's no such thing as rebirth, life after death, you know, holy people, they're all frauds. That kind of attitude. The Buddha said, but that's wrong view. That's not the way things are. It's a possibility. You can bear that in mind as a possibility. But if you hold fast to that view, that's very bad for you, to hold fast to that. So another excellent, very, very telling and useful thing to bear in mind, another simile the Buddha gave, is the simile of the raft. And he said, you know, this teaching is like a raft to be used, something to be used, not to be grasped. So he gave this simile, so you haven't heard it. He said, suppose somebody came to a river or a large body of water, and they were in danger where they were, and they needed to get to the other side. On the other side of the water is safety, on this side is danger. So they build a raft. Building this raft, they get it and they use it, and they're able to paddle across this stream to the other side, to safety. When they get there, this person then thinks, this raft has been really useful to me. I mean, thanks to this raft, I'm now safe. Before I was in danger, now I'm safe. What if I take it with me? And they kind of carry it on their back, and they start walking, carrying on their journey with this raft on their back. The Buddha said that's not the right attitude to have towards the raft. It was useful in crossing the water, it's true, but it's not any use now on the land. And in fact, it's a hindrance. To carry a raft around on your back now at this point is a hindrance. It's an obstacle. It will hold you back. In the same way, the teaching, he said, of the Buddha, or any kind of teaching or anything you find useful in life, if you grasp onto it, then it can hold you back. So he said, even good views, even right view, you should abandon it. Not to speak of wrong views, you know, mistaken ideas, but even good ideas. If you cling to them, then they'll hold you back. So even the Buddha's teachings, you should have this attitude of using it for its purpose. But then when it served its purpose, you don't need to carry it around with you. Now, this doesn't mean people can say, yeah, because I'm not attached to these things. I'm not attached to the Buddha's teachings. So I'm not attached to the precepts, especially the fifth precept about not drinking alcohol. So people abandon these. That's like abandoning things. You're halfway across the stream and you decide, I'm not attached to this, and you jump overboard and drown. You use these things when they're useful, in the context when they're useful. But then you don't grasp to them. You don't hold on to them fast and just take too much of it, just this clinging to these ideas. So even good views, so this is this attitude towards knowledge and beliefs. Even good views you should abandon or hold very lightly. So Ajahn Chah, the teacher of Ajahn Brahm's teacher of the most of the Western Sangha, he used to very often use this phrase, probably pronounce it wrong if I use the Thai. So it's usually translated not sure, means uncertainty. Whatever happens, whatever you think, just remind yourself, that's uncertain, that's not sure. So if you think, it's like this or it's like that, to constantly bear in mind, but that's not certain, maybe I'm wrong. To have this attitude in mind, the Buddha taught this, unless I've misunderstood it, so it's not sure. Or this person is like this, he's like that, she's like that, yeah, I don't like that. But that's not sure, maybe I'm wrong. So always bear that in mind, always have that in mind. And this guards against the danger of ditti, views, good or bad, you know, even to hold to good views is bad, but to hold to wrong views is very bad. So if, say, your attitude to rebirth is that, I don't believe in rebirth, you know, scientists have proved that the mind is just an effect of the brain, and when the brain dies, you're dead, and that's that. You know, so lots of Buddhists have a real problem with this, with the rebirth. To just, that view, it's all rubbish. This is clinging to a view, it's not so good. So just remind yourself, it's uncertain. Not sure. Maybe it's true. Or if you think there's no God, I don't believe in God myself. But maybe I'm wrong. You know, maybe it's not true. The proper attitude in all of these things is really a kind of agnostic attitude, is that I don't know. The difference between this kind of agnosticism and those who call themselves agnostics about religious matters is that the Buddha taught you can find these things out, though, for yourself. You don't have to always remain ignorant. You can find these things out. They are testable. So just as I said earlier, you can verify the Buddha's teachings, even the teachings on rebirth and previous lives and all this. Get enlightened, and then you'll know. You know, okay, it's not easy, but Buddha said if you meditate, remove the hindrances. The reason logic and reasoning doesn't work, won't get you there, is because it's based on delusion and our deluded ideas. We see what we want to see. You know, even just vision, you know. If you're expecting to see something, that's what you see, which is why eyewitness accounts are so unreliable. People see what they think they're going to see or what fits in with their belief system. And so your beliefs affect what you see. What you see then feeds back into what you believe. And in this, you know, never-ending circle of feedback, of reinforcing wrong ideas. So the Buddhist way, in brief, is to... through meditation, to calm the mind down and remove the hindrances in the mind, the obstructions which make us see things wrong. The doubt is one of them. Doubt is an obstruction. So lack of confidence, uncertainty, and then desire, aversion, restlessness, drowsiness of mind. These things obscure our vision. When these things are removed, the mind's purified. And the way that's done, the method of Buddhism, is meditation. So that's like the method of investigation. And it's direct investigation. So the experiments we're doing, the kind of experimental method, is to meditate, remove the obstructions in the mind until you can see clearly, and then put your mind on the important questions. Why do we suffer? What's the cause of suffering? And how can it be ended? And through this, insight arises. Now, the difference between that kind of knowledge and the knowledge from working things out, it's just like the idea of... some things you know it, but you haven't really seen it. It hasn't really sunk in. And this kind of knowledge means it's when it sinks in. So even if you believe, believe in rebirth, you can believe in karma and things. If you haven't seen it for yourself, it's just a belief, and a belief won't liberate you. Take the idea that you're going to die. We all know we're going to die. Eventually, you cotton on. Some people deny it, and my dad used to deny he was going to die. I don't know if he was really serious, actually, but he was definitely in denial about it. And there are people who believe they won't die, the immortalists, who say, well, you know, if you believe you're not going to die, you won't die. And when they're asked, well, what about these other immortalists who've died? They say, well, they didn't believe enough, you see. That's the difference. But all of them have died so far when they've reached the appropriate age. But anyway, most people believe, we all accept we're going to die. But actually, most of us, including myself, don't really believe it, actually. It hasn't really sunk in. We all know we're going to die, but we behave as if we're going to live forever. If you knew you were going to be dead within a week, there's probably a lot of things that you wouldn't bother doing because they're just not important, and you've only got 7 days to live. But the fact that you're going to live, you've only got 30 years to live, sometimes these things they're worth doing. You know? Because we're living as if we've got all the time in the world. That's something that hasn't really sunk in. Hasn't really sunk into us that we are really going to die. So knowing something with the mind is not the same as it really sinking in. Things sink in when the mind is calm enough to see clearly. And this comes about through calming the mind through meditation. So, to sum up, if I can sum up, the attitude to faith is good, and faith is necessary in the sense of having confidence that something's worth trying. You have to have some kind of faith, or else you won't even bother trying. But it's not faith in the sense of deluding yourself into thinking you already know what you don't yet know. You don't actually know. So remind yourself, it's uncertain. I don't know. Skepticism is also good. Not to just believe something because someone tells you. Because they might be wrong. People often are. So you have to see for yourself. doubting, again, in a sense it's good, in the sense of skepticism, in the sense of reminding yourself that this isn't certain. But in the sense of being, not knowing what to do, you're at a fork in the road, and you're, do I go left, do I go right, do I go left? You can end up spending your whole life trying to make a decision and not wanting to make the decision in case you make the wrong decision. So you do nothing instead and get nowhere. So make a decision. Try one thing. If you don't know which is the right thing to do, well, just try one of them. If it doesn't work, then you can go back and try the other thing. But if you spend all your time wondering, then you'll get nowhere, and you can save a lot of time just by learning from your mistakes. I don't know if I can sum it up any more simply than that and remember what I've said. So I'll finish there, and if anything I haven't covered or anyone's got any questions, then now's probably a good time to ask questions. I thought we had a question. Yes?
Do you think real wisdom has a somatic component?
Has a what?
Somatic component in the body.
Somatic, okay.
It's a gut feeling when it hits you, it comes from not deductive, as you were talking about before, but something that rises up from the body as well.
When you meditate, you realize, it becomes apparent that the body and the mind are very connected in strange ways, and especially the emotions, and all the kind of the emotions we experience. They kind of live in the body in certain places, and it's obvious with some. You get butterflies in your stomach and a lump in your throat and things. But even other more subtle emotions, you gradually realize that these things you're holding in your body. So in that sense, the you can learn a lot through being aware of your body. The idea of the phrase you use, gut feeling, that's something to beware of. You might have a gut feeling that something's true. The problem is how to know the difference between intuition, a true intuition, and a belief or a desire or wishful thinking. So the fact that something just seems, that seems true. Again, it's always good to remind yourself, but it's not sure. I mean, when you really know, there's something about real knowledge. That when you really know, you know, you don't just know, but you know you know. Unfortunately, when you're deluded, you think you know. like in the Buddha's time, someone went to him once and said, your disciples, many of them are enlightened, are they all enlightened, the ones who think they are? Are some of them deluding themselves? And the Buddha said, no, some of them are deluding themselves. Some of them think they're enlightened, but they're not. And they had the Buddha to tell them, you're not. Yeah. So there is a problem there. And that's why you have to constantly question and just bear in mind the alternatives. But as for the body, what relation the body has in wisdom, I don't know. It seems more to do with emotions to me. But that's, I don't know, not sure. No. Insight. Yes. Well, again, I found that when certain get insights in meditation, there tends to be then a release of some kind of tensions and things in the body. They kind of go along with it in stages, but I think that they tend, in my experience, that more insights to do with my tensions and the way my mind works. What happens with the body when, in terms of enlightenment experiences, I don't know. Certainly the body, things happen in the body in tandem with things happening in the mind through meditation, and it is important, which is why it is very useful to be aware of the body, and the body just as a meditation object is very useful. Rather, in a sense, the mindfulness of the breathing is a kind of awareness of the body as well. So the body is important. Is that... that's the word that people use to translate. The word they're usually translating is Bodhi, which literally means awakening. So it's many people prefer the word awakening. The Buddha was the awakened one. He didn't say, I'm enlightened one. He said, I'm the awakened one. And it's the same word that was used, it's like when you get up in the morning, you wake up and then get out of bed. That word is budjati in Pali, and bodhi is the past participle or whatever of it, you know, awakened. So the Buddha said, I am the awakened one. But it got translated as enlightened by 19th century translators who were inspired by the European Enlightenment, so they used the word enlightened. The Buddha used the image of light at times. You know, I became, you know, when he said I was awakened, light arose, and because light is a kind of an image we all use for, you know, when you're confused, it's dark. When you're everything's clear, it's bright, a light. You know, but it's just a word, an English word. So the Buddha's the awakened one. So we're awake. So we're awakening from ignorance, from delusion. So that's the proper simile, really. In referring to what? The rebirth thing. Not experiments. They're just. There's books in the library about it. He's asking about what evidence there is for rebirth. For about 40 years, 50 years now, actually, people have been collecting cases which are less rare than anyone thought, including the people doing the studies, cases of children. As soon as they can speak, they start talking about the house they lived in before and the mummy and daddy they had before. And, you know, I lived in a big house. When I was big, my name was this and that, and I lived in such and such a place, and this happened to me, and this is how I died. They usually remember their deaths. And cases where the things they say can be verified, can be checked, and they go and check, and they find there was somebody who with that name who lived in such and such a place who died in exactly that way. And this is a child who's just begun to speak. And they're usually very, very insistent about it. They're quite emotionally attached to this idea and demand to be taken to the house and things. And then investigators have studied, followed up lots of these cases. And they've got a few thousand cases that they've studied in detail. There's not many people investigating it, because there's not a lot of research funds for that kind of thing. But the evidence, to my surprise, actually, even though I could have come around to the idea of rebirth, to my surprise, there's a lot of evidence, because some of these cases, it's very difficult to account, almost impossible, really, by any other way, because you can check, you know, is it just a fraud on the part of the parents? Is it... you know, they heard about it from somewhere else and things like this. And you can rule a lot of these things out. When they're talking about someone who lived hundreds of miles away in a poor village in India or something. And it's all over the world. It's not just in India and Sri Lanka and places. It's in America and Europe and South America. But anyway, you have to read the books to convince yourself, because, I mean, they're just anecdotes. Because they've been tabulated and these people are interviewed and so forth, the evidence is very strong, actually. And it's more common than I would have thought. So people do sometimes remember, it seems.
Yeah, sort of. I was aware of that.
So that's what I mean by the evidence. Yeah.
Like now they can prove this energy as in chi around six They can't prove that scientifically.
Yeah. In terms of experimental evidence, no, because it's difficult. How do you experiment? You know, kill someone and see where they pop up again. You know. I mean, you get this... This is the thing about the scientific method is different from the method of mysticism, if you like, or of Buddhism. when I hear about the idea of weighing people on hospital beds, waiting until they die and see if they can weigh the soul, which looks like a ridiculous... I mean, it's worth trying, I suppose, just once or twice to see if it works. But it seems to be about a completely wrong way. There's a debate with a skeptic in the Buddha's teachings. It wasn't the Buddha himself, it was one of his disciples. And he's debating with someone who doesn't believe in rebirth and the life after. And he's giving his various reasons for not believing. And they're all kind of logical reasons. You know. I've talked to people and said, right, when you die, okay, come back and tell me. You know, could have come back as a ghost and tell me what happens. And no one's ever come back and told me. You know. And he says... This was a prince. He said, sometimes I have to have people executed. So what I did was I got this guy, put him in a pot, and boiled him, sealed it, and boiled him to death. And then opened the pot to see if we could see his soul coming out. And I couldn't see anything. And so this is very similar to the idea of weighing people's hospital beds. Just excuse me. And this monk pointed out, he says, you're going about it the wrong way, basically. And he gave an amusing simile about people trying to get sound out of a horn by talking to it and banging it and instead of just blowing in it. And it's the same kind of thing. It's a kind of category error, a mistake to try to approach these kind of things by these other methods. So the scientific method of doing experiments and in labs doesn't work with examining the mind, which is why the mind is the last huge mystery in science, because it's the thing about all of our minds is that you experience it from the inside, not from the outside, and you can't really experiment on other people's minds. So they could try to convince themselves that they can understand it in terms of the brain functioning, but they do know an awful lot about the brain, and it interacts with the mind. There's obviously a connection there. Bang someone on the head, they lose consciousness. Give them a lobotomy, they lose a lot of their faculties. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's simple cause and effect, that the brain causes the mind. But that was a kind of working hypothesis which has been assumed, now it's just assumed to be true, but it's by no means proved. So the scientific method is a bit at a loss here. The method, but it is as scientific in its own way, is to use meditation, to look inside your own mind. But but you don't use reason, because you can't trust it. And also, you don't just trust any experience you have. You can sit in meditation, have wild experiences, and then just think, that was it, I just saw God. Or, that was my soul. I was one with my soul then. But these are just ideas. You know, do you really know that? Yeah. What the Buddha said when he looked in meditation, he said, I entered the first meditation. There was joy, there was thinking, there was one pointedness of mind, there was awareness, there was tranquility. He lists the kind of psychological factors that are present. He didn't say, oh, you know, I saw God, or I joined with Brahman. Just there were these factors. And in the deeper meditation, there was joy, there wasn't any thinking anymore. There was still tranquility, and so forth. And he analyzes it just in terms of bare experience. What do you actually see? Which is why the Buddha then came up with his bizarre teaching that there's no soul. You don't have a soul. You're reborn, but there's no soul. It seems contradictory. But the Buddha said, well, I've looked, and I haven't found a soul. I found thoughts, memories, feelings, consciousness, all these things. But all of them change all the time. So there's no one thing which stays the same. So, and that's what people mean by a soul. So it's not there. So it's investigation, but you've got to use the right tools. Any other questions? No? Okay. Okay. I have to be a quick one. Letting go is not grasping at it. This is the thing. It's like not being too taken up with it. So you have a ditti, you know, views. Ditti is the Pali word. They're very dangerous things. If you hold very, very fast to a view, if it's wrong, then it can lead you very seriously astray. So this is why one factor of the Eightfold Path is having right view, not believing. If you believe and absolutely adamant, you know, there's no God, there's no life after death, there's karma's the rubbish, it's just taught to people to frighten them into being good. If you have this as an idea is okay, but if you have that as a view and really hold fast to it, then it will severely, you know, screw you up. And the Buddha said it'll lead to bad rebirths, actually, if you hold very, very strongly to these kind of views. Or if you hold other views, like what you do to people doesn't matter, they're just made up of elements. If you there's no real person there anyway, so what you do to other people, there's no bad karma. Now, this is a very, very pernicious view. So in that sense, holding on to wrong views is bad, obviously. Problem with holding on to good views, clinging to them, is that it leads to kind of inflexibility in the mind, for a start. And you need to be flexible. You need to, in meditation and in learning, you need to be open to other possibilities. If you think you know everything already, then you can't learn anything new. This is one of the problems that science can fall into, is that scientists tend to, instead of identifying with a method, they tend to identify with a load of ideas. So the idea that the mind is just the body, that's become very, very prominent. Most neuroscientists and scientists believe that now. It's just an idea, but they cling to it so much, they just, even when there's evidence, it's like, well, if the mind is just the body, how come these kids can remember previous lives? You know, and there's a lot of evidence that they really do. But they're so committed to that idea, then they just, well, okay, I refuse to believe that evidence. So they don't remember. They're just their stories. Kids will say anything. You know? And people won't see the evidence. So if you cling to an idea, if it's 99% right but 1% wrong, it'll hold you back from seeing new things. So that's one problem with it, is that also it can lead you to think, if you cling too much to ideas, you can end up thinking you know when really you just believe. It's as well to remember always that, you know, like the elephant, the guy tracking the elephant, you don't come to the conclusion that I know, yes, it definitely the Buddha is totally enlightened, this is the way. You don't know that until you've got there yourself. You can end up deluding yourself into thinking you're enlightened. It's just the attitude, what it does to your mind when you cling to ideas too much. Another thing is that you get very angry when people disagree with you. You know, if you really believe, if you're really devoted to the Buddha and his teachings, and people say, ah, the Buddha, really selfish, left his wife and kids, you know, kind of sit in the forest, look after his own thing, really selfish. You get annoyed if you hear this kind of thing, if you're too attached to your teacher or to his teachings. So this is a danger as well. So there's a number of dangers in that attitude. When I say about letting go, though, I'm not referring to just abandoning it, just thinking, yeah, the Buddha taught this, but I should let go, so you just forget it. You just keep practicing if it's useful, but just remember to hold it lightly, to hold all your views lightly. Well, as in Charmin, I think, by mine air, uncertainty, it's not sure. To always bear that in mind. Do you see what I mean? No? Right. Yes, yeah. Right. Well, that's what we tend to do. Yeah. Exactly. Well, yes, because you think this teaching, you know, Buddhism, Christianity, whatever, you know, before you have faith, and then you can get a lot from religious teachings. And then people tend to become very, very, you know, the born again kind of attitude. You know, can't stop pestering other people with it and stuff, because it's been so incredibly useful that you can't just put it in context and just think, okay, it's good, but, you know, don't get carried away. Okay. That's enough.